This is Sustainable East End, a monthly series about how land use, water resources, energy, transportation, and food impact the environment of the Twin Forks of Long Island. With co-producer Tony Ernst, I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Recently, I talked with landscape architect and activist Edwina Van Gaal at her magnificent gardens in East Hampton, New York. Edwina is a proponent of planting native shrubs and an opponent of the use of pesticides, which kill the bees and insects vital for pollination and our food supply. In an earlier episode, we spoke with her about her project, Two Thirds for the Birds. It's about planting two-thirds native species for every one-third of exotics in your yard or garden. We also talked about living with deer, which mount major assaults on the underbrush in the forests and gardens across the East End. Edwina says there are many shrubs and plants which deer will not eat. Here's our conversation. So, Edwina Van Gaal, as we are here, we are in the middle of these beautiful gardens. Can you point out to us some examples of the pollinator-friendly plants that you've planted here?
Sure. This side of the garden is the side where deer are. Another thing that really needs to be addressed is the deer population, because deer are eating so many of our native wildflowers that the availability for pollinators to access wildflowers is becoming very limited. Also, deer are eating what's called recruitment. Every forest has a new forest growing up from its feet, the one that will be the forest 100 years from now. And trees are always dying and being replaced. But that replacement is called recruitment, and that is not happening because the baby trees, as they come out, the seedling trees are being eaten. There is no understory, so there's no place for ground nesting birds to hide. There's no place for fruit-bearing shrubs to live because the deer are eating them all. So that's a problem. So I have made about two-thirds of my property is fenced from deer, and about a third is deer accessible, so people can see the difference.
So now we're talking about deer-resistant, not deer-proof, I assume?
I go for deer-proof, because deer-resistant just means that maybe they will and maybe they won't, and chances are they will, at least my deer will. Mm-hmm. So I do... If people ask, I will say resistant may work for you, but it hasn't worked for me. These plants are deer proof.
I didn't know there was any such a thing.
Well, can I promise that if you're at your house, they won't eat them? No, I can't altogether. But one of the things I know they don't eat is carexes, which is sedges, these little grasses. Grasses provide tremendous ecosystem service for pollinators, and which people don't realize. And in most cases, the deer don't eat them.
These little
mop heads here. So I have a lot of different kinds of carexes, but the one that grows here in wild in our woods is the Pennsylvania sedge. And it's that beautiful, soft thing. It's semi-evergreen. It's stoloniferous, which means it spreads by roots. So if you get a good crop of it, it's a really wonderful. And I have ferns here for some reason I don't fully understand. These ferns, which have been eaten to the ground by the deer year after year, this year, they're not. I think partly it may be that I've been here so much due to COVID, and that we're so actively working in these beds now. And I've added, check this out, this is American Pachysandra, and it just finished blooming. You can see the remains of the blossoms right down there. And this is its new crop of leaves. Down here on the ground is the old last year's leaves. And everybody grows the Japanese Pachysandra because it does fill in a lot faster. But it doesn't play well with others. You just get a really boring, big, massive green. Whereas this, you can see, is mixed in with the ferns. It's mixed in with the Japanese grass, that's Hakana Kloa, which doesn't spread and does really well in difficult conditions. I do not use mulch. Mulch is a weed inhibitor, but it's as such a growth inhibitor. My mulch is plants. If you look in nature, every space is taken, right? Nature abhors a vacuum. Just use that, because people use mulch to fill in. And if you can't afford to fill your garden with plants, make a smaller garden for now. Fill it up solid. So this, as you can see, we're poking stuff into every patch of earth here, just by little plants. Now this one you're looking at is a hellebore. That is not native, but they bloom very early, and there is a lot of pollen there, and the bees do love it. This is the new growth in the leaves, and those are the flowers, which are now setting seed. And they're just a beautiful plant. And now there are a lot of hybrid hellebores. You can see this one over here that is still a bit in bloom, but pretty much over. So they're very popular in the nurseries now because they're deer proof. Mm-hmm. They nobody seems to have ever had a hellebore eaten, I don't think.
Can they be planted now?
Sure. Yeah, they can be planted. If something comes in a pot, plant it. Yeah. You know, Rosemary Veery, who was a great garden, like, English authority back when I was starting out, and I went to visit her once in her garden, and she offered me something, and I said, well, it's not really the time to dig that right now, is it? And she said, my dear, the time to take a cutting is when it's offered. So it's sort of the same, you know, if you got it, plant it. And I mean, it's not the middle of the summer is not the best time to whack something out of the ground, but it's always the right time to put something in the ground.
Now, we see a very big leaf plant over here. What's this?
This is kind of not for beginners, in a way, although maybe by default. This is Petasites, which is a Japanese plant called butterbur. It's terribly invasive, but it isn't, because it will only grow as far as its preferred conditions allow. And up until now, I don't know of it, like, you don't see it wild on the roadside. And that's, to me, that's the dividing line between what's just a thug, what we call a garden thug, which is just like aggressive versus invasive. And so I have this birdbath here, and I keep water dripping on it all the time. So the water that drips out of there provides the Petasites. It likes moist soil, but it's growing in basically a sandy forest soil. So it's not going to get much beyond the drip of this fountain, this birdbath. So it's like creeping out here and there, but it's never going to get very far. And the deer don't eat it. And it does have a very early blossom. So one of the really important things for pollinator plantings is the long season. There are bees that start coming out of the ground. Things start waking up early. They need something. They need pollen. So you want to be there for them. So there's a really great shrub called Lindera, which is a native shrub that, for whatever reason, the deer don't eat. The flowers are pretty, or what they call insignificant. You know, they're hard to see, but if you plant it right by your door, you're going to see them. They're this pale yellow, teeny flowers, except they're covered with pollinators early in the spring, and it blooms like late February, March. Yeah, and the deer don't eat it. Other than that, like, it's just like, it's a fairly nondescript shrub. But if you're thinking that way, plant things that will bloom early. Also, the other one that blooms early is the spring witch hazel, which is Hamamelis vernalis, vernal being spring. And then there's also a Hamamelis virginiana. That's the late season witch hazel. Not as showy, but still, it's giving pollinators something to hit on, like, way into October, November.
So these deer-proof plants, are they also pollinator-friendly?
Oh, sure. Well, the American Pachycandra is totally pollinator-friendly, and so far has not been eaten. So here it is, here and there, all around. That's another hellebore. This is Leucothoe, an American shrub that looks a little sad because it got moved recently, but it'll perk up. And it's starting to bloom. It's a great, great shrub. It's very slow growing, which people sometimes don't like, but the fact is, in the long run, it works for you, you know, because once it's established, it's not going to take over the side of your house. And there are two kinds of leucothoe. This is the axillaris, the low one. And so it just, for me, it's like a great replacement for where you might use boxwood. It's softer. It's not a tight little mound. I'm not a big fan of things that look like geometrics. Mm-hmm. I like stuff that combines with others. Plants are social. So just think of a party, you know, and if people were all standing around a party looking like balls and rectangles, you wouldn't get the feeling that this was a good party, would you? No, you know, they're not partying. And to my mind, it should all be like this great mingling, post-COVID, hugging, embracing, touching, and that's what a garden really is meant to be. So what I do, if you can see this one, we're just putting all these plants in, it's completely, every space is filled. And what we do is take things from seed. I throw a lot of seed down. And even something that's not native, like sweet alyssum, which the deer won't eat, you can throw that seed down once you plant your bed, and it'll just fill in like crazy all between. If your space doesn't have deer, use Rudbeckia, like Rudbeckia hirta, which is the, is that brown-eyed Susan, I think, or black-eyed, one or the other. Anyway, the first year, you'll just get this incredible carpet of fuzzy leaves, just like tight. So that's like all of the weeds are smothered out because you get that in there first, and it covers the ground. The second year, it comes up and blooms. The third year, you'll have less. And then as the plants you planted grow in, it'll fade out. And people have always said, oh, I don't like Rudbeckias because it never lasts. Well, it's not really, that's not the plant it is. It's a pioneer. It's there to get things started. So if you disturb areas of your garden, then it can keep coming back. So you'd have to keep disturbing and making openings for it. But I'm fine with it disappearing over time.
And I also see some flowering trees here.
Oh, yeah. So this is, I'm calling this part of the garden the Carolinas, because that is, this is a Carolina silverbell, Halicia. And over there is the Carolina allspice, which is calycanthus. And it has dark maroon flowers that are incredibly fragrant. And these are just beloved. You can see the bees on the silver bell. See them all buzzing around in there? It's full of them. Yeah.
Yes, quite a few.
Yeah. So that, and I loved when they hang upside down, because the silver bell is pretty, that the blossoms hang down, and then the bees have to go in and hang and look up into the face of the flower and get their nectar and the pollen. And I just love that. Because I can sit, so this is my terrace. So when right outside my office, when things get a little bit like, ugh, I just come out here and watch the bees.
Now I see a few more deer. Can you point out a few more deer-proof plants here?
Yes, I can. Natives. This is aconitum, which is monk's hood. This is a great one because it's really late in the season to bloom. And it monk's hood has that it's like a curled, like a hood, a hoodie, and it's deep purple. It's a really beautiful plant. Takes a long time to get established. It's slow growing. I did find when I first planted, the deer munched it for a while, but after a while it seemed to get ahead. There is a theory that when plants come out of a nursery, number one, that they're juiced up with fertilizers. That makes them sweeter. Mm-hmm. They have more sugars. Number two, so that the deer are more likely to eat them. And number two, some people think that when a plant is subjected to stress, it has a good mycorrhizal mm-hmm. capacity in the soil.
Mycorrhizal?
That's the fungal component of the soil biome. So the soil microbiome is like your gut biome. It's helping with natural immunities, so that the plant will actually start to create a defense system against deer. I mean, it has to be already somewhat inclined. But that as the plants get more established, so that's what you asked me about your ferns, and like maybe my ferns have just now gotten to the point where they have developed enough of a immunity. it's a theory, you know. But what's amazing is that things that used to be like crystals and rainbows and throw in a unicorn theories, like, are now proving to be fact, like that an adult tree recognizes its young. Yes, and that's now proven. And that has to do with the mycorrhizal network, that underground is this massive fungal life system that can communicate and sends messages through the soil to roots. So certain trees actually send help to other trees. They send warnings when predators are coming. And most of this has been done with trees, but like, if it works for trees, why wouldn't it be working for our ferns and my aconitums?
So. Wow. This is Sustainable East End on WPKN Radio. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and we're talking with Edwina van Gaal, landscape designer extraordinaire, speaking with us at her gardens in East Hampton, New York.
That's the aconitums. This one is one of my really favorite plants. That's a Cimicifuga.
A what?
It's a Cimicifuga. And then they're always changing the names in Latin, so now it's Actea, but I think it's called black cohosh, which there's nothing black about it, so, you know, go figure on that.
That's a medicinal herb.
Probably, and it's native, and the deer have not touched it, and I've had it for a while. I'm moving it around. It has these beautiful, tall, skinny racemes that go up and then tip over at the top. And so on into the winter, in the fall, you leave them up. Never cut your garden back in the fall. It's the home for everything. That's where do all these things go in the winter? To the ground, to the leaves, to the stems, everything. They're living at the base of everything. And your standing seed heads are what birds feast on all winter. All of those seeds. So they'll come and visit them. The birds that haven't left for the winter, and some of our insects migrate, like everybody knows about the monarchs, but many, many of them, and most of our bees don't leave. They're all here. They're all hunkered down. So they'll come down with the leaves. And if you're out there with a blower blasting the stuff away from under your trees, well, that's your moth and butterfly population. Completely.
How about mulching the leaves?
Oh, you can mulch mow. It does some damage to your resident populations, but in many cases it works well because I do a certain amount of mulch mowing and put the leaves back on especially my shrub beds, but I try to keep a good percentage of leaves intact.
But I don't see any leaves here on these lawns.
Oh, it blows away over the winter. Well, this grass area gets mowed. So it's all mulch mowed and it grows right back in the ground. We don't take anything away. It just mulch mow it and back in the soil, which is important. And ideally, and then we do leave stuff under the trees that just stays. And then at different times during the years, like we try to keep some that we don't mow every year, mm-hmm. and some other we mow, like, so it's a rotation of what gets mowed. In any given year, we try to leave a third of the property not mowed, or of the meadow areas, so that there's a third of a population at least that isn't getting. Yeah. I mean, and we don't cut until as late as possible. So the meadow out there, we just cut that last week. And it's even a bit early because you see the green isn't really showing that much. Most of the grasses in meadows in the Northeast are warm season grasses. So they're the kind that grow like humps. They're clump forming grasses. You don't want to shave that clump off. And most mowers can't be set high enough to miss them. So we do it with weed whackers. And we cut about 8 to 12 inches high. And then we remove that and make haystacks because you need to keep a meadow lean.
Wow, that's great.
There's another one here is Amsonia hubrecti, which we were talking about this morning. I think it's called Blue Star. The trouble with common names, and like I know it sounds like so off-putting to be always saying the Latin names, but it wasn't meant to be. It's just that those are accurate, but then they're not, because then they'd go and change mommy. But there are so many different common names for the plants that if you went and asked for this plant, they might not have it by that name. So if you're armed with the Latin name, you'll get the plant you want, provided the garden center you go to is reasonably up to speed. One of the first things to do to being a good steward of the earth is actually know the names of what's living with you. Mm-hmm. This is a life or death kind of thing. And so if you don't even know their names and you don't know what they like, and it's like raising kids, like you should know them a little better than that if they're going to, right? Or unless you just hand them over to a nanny. And that's what people are doing. But they're handing them over to landscapers who don't know their names either. And that's a real problem. So the first thing is that you are really in the end, like you're responsible. It's your property or it's your favorite place. So take responsibility and get to know a little bit about it. And it can be really fun. Sure. And you know, you're making me think that we should probably post some lists of what I just said so you could refer people to it.
Yes.
And so, because I'm just blabbing on here, and this way I can...
I mean, Deer Proof plants would be...
You could have a list of plants that I could call Deer Proofish.
Yeah, that would be great.
And I could have a list of plants that are Deer Proofish, native, non-native.
Yeah.
And then just other... Now, so this area is... Yeah, there's moss. That's Deer Proof. And if you get it right... You know, it's pretty low maintenance.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's taking me a little time to get it right, but it's happening. And this area is our ground cover trials, so to speak. So I'm trying out all these different kinds of ground covers. Originally, we were trying them out to see if deer ate them, which they did. So now that it's fenced, I don't have to worry about that anymore. And they ate most of them, or at least they ate the flowers off. So, but there are so many really beautiful Native American ground covers that people can use to fill in all the soil. So these I just planted at the end of last summer, and you can see there's almost no visible soil left, which we'll be filling in quickly. So these are bee bombs, mountain mints, pachyra, don't ask me the name, the common name. And then there's chrysogonum, which is called, I think it's called yellow star or something, that one there. And they're just all sorts of, like, and they just fill in. Mahania the deer don't prefer, but they might eat the flowers because mm-hmm. that's in the all those in the mint family. Mm-hmm. And so then what we're doing back here, so back here where this is where, like, it gets, this is all going to be just shady area. There's shade, there's sun, and it's trees and shrubs, a lot of trees and shrubs, because this American dogwood. And over there is American fringe tree. We have in the back over there, American magnolia, Magnolia virginiana, the swamp magnolia, which is a really beautiful tree. It blooms all summer so that it's not as showy as the spring blooming ones, but it's fragrant and it's just charming, you know, so. And it's these are all shrubs that, like, go to your nurseries, ask for them. And if they don't have them, just keep going back or say, can you order me one? Or order it online and just say, I'm sorry, nursery, you're like, I'm like somebody else is getting my business. But they need to know that, you know, that your business is going elsewhere because they're not providing you with this service that you need. And I'm so happy because now everywhere you turn, people are talking about native plants. And sooner or later, the industry will have to respond. But they are not properly prepared at this time for this demand.
Can you get decent plants from online?
Oh, yeah. That Elysium I showed you earlier, that I bought online. And looking just the way it does. Pretty amazing, right? Yeah. Yeah, you sure can. I try to find the ones, there are even some now that grow without chemicals. I'm not terribly fussy about that because they won't have a life with chemicals after they get here, and that'll be fine. You know, so I just like to patronize the companies that make that effort. which isn't, but many of them are to the trade only, so that's hard for the average shopper. But the where I get all these little specialty ones, those are not. Those are just regular online, and it's just fun to do of a winter's evening as I start Googling unusual native plants, and you never know what you're going to come up with. There is a great plant database on Audubon. The Audubon website, just ask for their, just Google their plant database. You put in your zip code, and it's really beautiful. It's not like 100% every single native plant you could grow, but it's a really nice way to get started in the whole thing.
And these are for birds.
Yes, and they tell you what birds they will attract. There is one on, what is it, National Wildlife Federation? They have one that's a little bit more comprehensive in terms of different plant-animal associations, so it'll have insects and things on it too. Yes.
So what are we seeing over here? I assume these are pollinator or bird-friendly?
These are beds in the making, because we're about to build an outdoor classroom. And yeah, so everybody can come. So I can actually have my office in my garden. This is a long-term dream of mine that, you know, so now I'll have a table and Wi-Fi, and I can sit out here, because I come out here, I work, and I go back inside. And I thought, that's silly. Why can't I stay outside and watch this? You know, I've never, like, I'm always like butt up, head down out here. And I thought, what if I just could sit here and look up and see it? So we're reorganizing our beds. Plus, we got the deer fence. So these beds are all in transition. But these will be an example of what kind of two-thirds in action. Largely native, but a third non. And just, but all really serving pollinators. So that's the vegetable garden, because the vegetable and cutting garden, that's like the garden for people, you know. This is just, and so everything, and that's like the difference to me. Agriculture is food for people. Horticulture should be food for everything else on earth. Nice. And that's not the way it's been thought of traditionally, but that's my ask for everyone, is make your horticulture your a salad bar for everything but you, you know, and share. You got to share it. And if you, like, if something bites on it, that's good. But these are my cutting flowers, you know, which, no, I don't really want something to munch on them too bad, but there's enough to go around. And the same thing, like, yeah, obviously there are certain pests in your vegetables that you do have to control to some extent, but there are lots of ways to do it without killing them. Mm-hmm. You can net them and stuff that anything is a pesticide that kills a pest. So that if you can hold off and hope that some natural predator will come in, the natural predators are not sitting around with nothing to eat, waiting for you to have something for them to eat. So if you do have a pest, the natural predators aren't going to necessarily be there right away. Mm-hmm. Give them a chance to get there. Give them a chance, because your pest problem has to get to a sufficient population that they are recognizable to the predators passing by.
Edwina van Gaal, landscape designer and activist, speaking with us at her gardens in East Hampton, New York. You've been listening to Sustainable East End. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Information about the deer-proof or deer-resistant plants we heard of today from Edwina van Gaal will be posted at sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is heard on the third Wednesday of each month at this time, and also on the second Saturday of each month at 9 a.m. Programs are archived at www.sustainableeastend.blogspot.com. Sustainable East End is produced by Tony Ernst and yours truly, Francesca Rhiannon.